Good afternoon. It's right about 3 o'clock. You are tuned to KTOO News in Juneau here on Friday, the 15th of August, the year 2014. Jeff Brown here with you on a Juneau afternoon, filling in for Pat Moore today. We'll talk with Kathy Connor about the Juneau Icefield Research Program. Katie Bosler will be here with a UAS update. We'll talk with filmmaker Bob Boudar about Walking in Two Worlds, about the Tongass National Forest screening tonight at the Silver Bow. And we'll talk with patients in town from Zimbabwe for a marimba workshop on this week's Food Truck Friday. And writers Almanac Bird Note News for more today on in Juneau afternoon. With the forecast for tonight, numerous showers diminishing with patchy fog later on, low temperatures around 53 degrees. Most of the cloudy skies expected on Saturday and rain predicted for Sunday.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The tribe in Bethel, Alaska, is responding to allegations that a city police officer used excessive force with a Native man in July and are asking the public to report any mistreatment. KYUK's Daisha Eaton reports.
Gloria Simeon, the president of ONC, Bethel's tribe, says the problem is instability with the city administration.
Going on with four city managers, it's been hard to set up meetings to deal directly with these problems, and we're hoping that by taking this action and making a press release that we cannot tolerate this kind of behavior and this fear.
Simeon says ONC's tribal council met with the city of Bethel's acting city manager and police chief during their regular monthly meeting on August 6th. They discussed allegations of police brutality made through a letter to the editor of the Delta Discovery newspaper on July 23rd. Simeon says the ONC Tribal Council has concerns about how the police are treating these categories of people.
The stereotypical Native male who is targeted, women alone at night on the streets, people who are inebriated and do not have control of their faculties are certainly the most vulnerable, and those are the people that we need to protect.
Simeon says the ONC Council hopes to work with the Bethel City Council to ensure that there are not violations of basic human rights and to improve the relationship of the Bethel Police Department with the community they serve. City of Bethel officials repeatedly declined to talk with KYUK last week about the allegations and investigation. In Bethel, I'm Daisha Eaton.
Native American and Western culture coming together at a fair and rodeo. KWSO's Will Robbins has more on this weekend's event.
Wasco County in Oregon was established in 1854 and was named for the Wasco, or Wascopum, Indian tribe. It's that unique aspect that makes this year's fair and rodeo one for the ages. During the event, there will be special exhibits and performances highlighting the history between Native American tribes of the Columbia River and Western settlers. One of those performances is a short play written by members of the Warm Springs tribes. Susie Slakish is part of the team that wrote the short play.
One of the members wrote up a script, and it's history of Tai Valley, how it was years and years ago when the Indians first started going down there.
The Wasco County Fair and Rodeo is one of 10 events in the state that is recognized as an Oregon Heritage Tradition by the Oregon Heritage Commission. The 100th Wasco County Fair and Rodeo runs through Sunday in Tai Valley, Oregon. For National Native News, I'm Will Robbins reporting.
A monument for missing and murdered Aboriginal women in Canada was unveiled this week in Winnipeg. The white, solid granite female form is more than 7 feet tall.
She is polished on the outer side and then carved rough on the inside. The beauty, but the hardness and the pain of life. And she's quite stunning.
That's Nahani Fontaine, Special Advisor on Aboriginal Women's Issues with the Manitoba government. Fontaine says more than 300 people were at the dedication, including family members of the missing and murdered.
When you feel that your loved one, who's either missing or who has been savagely murdered, for so many years, not getting the amount of attention that they need, or they feel that nobody cares, or there's been no resolution to their particular file and getting resolution within the judicial system, it's quite something extraordinary then to see this beautiful monument on this piece of ground at the forks where our two rivers meet. It meant a lot to the families to finally have somewhere where they can go to have their loved one acknowledged and honored and cherished.
The two-year project was a collaboration between family, the province, and an Aboriginal women's organization. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kawanic Broadcast Corporation, with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, and the Ford Foundation. The Convention and Tourism Department of the Albuquerque Hispano Chamber of Commerce provides convention and event planning services for Native American organizations. Information at ahcnm.org.
Our democracy is a government of the people, for the people. Let's keep it that way. Vote on November 4th. Get registered. Cast your vote. It's that simple. More information at nativenews.net. Brought to you by the Carnegie Corporation of New York and Kawanic Broadcast Corporation.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
Time is 3:05, and you are tuned to KTVO News in Juneau here on a Juneau afternoon. Our first guest is Kathy Connor from the ICL Research Program. We're going to talk about some presentations that are going on tomorrow night. Kathy, thank you for coming down the station.
Thank you, Jeff.
So first of all, for people who aren't familiar with it, can you describe the ICL Research Program?
So this is a program that had its beginnings in 1946 when Dr. Maynard Miller and some of his colleagues made their first crossing of the ice field and realized its potential as a research platform. And since that time, it's gone through different iterations. A lot of funding came initially from DOD during the Cold War to model cold regions, sort of navigation and logistics. There were some lunar landing scenarios, I think, done on the ice field. And so then up until late 50s, the International Geophysical Year occurred, and so it became an important place on the planet to monitor planetary things. And since that time, it's been kind of like the old canary in the coal mine. These temperate glaciers in Alaska are very sensitive to things and lately have been disappearing. So it's been a great climate sort of gauge.
Tell me more about Dr. Miller, please.
Dr. Miller just passed away this past February. He was 92, I believe, and just spent an amazingly long career being a researcher, a college professor. He was an Idaho legislator. He innovated a lot of research methods. He traveled the world and was kind of like the Pied Piper of glaciology. He got students to really respond and embrace this wonderful mountain world we have here.
So it started in the 40s. Was it kind of breaking ground as far as the techniques that he was using, and was it it's kind of scary for people?
Well, I think he was always a mountaineer. He grew up in Washington State and had, you know, was very familiar with Mount Rainier and had grown up, you know, climbing and such like that. So it was different from maybe World War II in Greenland or Antarctic expeditions in that our glaciers are so warm and wet that they cycle through very quickly. So they had to come up with ways to work on them without getting hypothermic and staying soggy so much.
How many students are up there this year?
This year we started with 35, and I think we're having 32 come down the home stretch, which is a huge year for us. We haven't had that many in a long while, so it's been a great summer.
What do they end up doing?
This summer they have done all kinds of stuff, and you can hear some of their reports on Saturday, tomorrow night. So we have people who are interested in cryobiology, which is the biology of the fern pack on top of the glacier. So looking at snow fleas and algae and the animals and plants that live in the fern pack.
And ice worms?
We don't have ice worms on the Juneau ice field, but other ice fields have them. There's going to be people who have been trying to assess what's going on in that sort of place between rain and glacier ice. How is that fern pack holding up? How's the rainwater moving through? And how much water is coming out the end of the glaciers? And this is important for the Canadians because they're getting all their hydropower out of the Llewellyn side of the Juneau ice field. So they want to know, how's our water going to hold up, and will we be able to plug in 20 years or 50 years, will we still have water coming out of this glacier? So a lot of people doing that. We have people tracking isotopes, certain kinds of atoms through snow to separate what the rain is doing versus the snow. We have people looking at the Taku Terminus, which is the only advancing part of all the ice field glaciers. Why is that one advancing and how is it doing it? We have people tracking the snow line on the Lemon Glacier, which is, you know, really disappearing compared with some of our other ones, looking at all sorts of mostly melting things and the advance of biology into the ice field because our ice field is fading fast in this warming climate.
I remember when I came into town, it looked substantially different and grander than before than what it is now, even though it's pretty darn grand now.
It's pretty darn grand, but there's a little bit of daunting to the grandness, I think.
What do you think is the most part in all this research?
I think that what the students, I think, exit with is this incredible sense of teamwork and working together collaboratively in often adverse and very cold and wet conditions to make things happen and to collect information that isn't always very easy to get.
Are they still marching the parade?
No, we had to shift the whole program forward, number one, to get more sun for them, because weather is always better in June. And also, when the VFW shut down, we moved the base camp to UAS, and UAS is starting in August now, so we had to kind of shift it between the end of, you know, spring semester and the beginning of fall. So,
how long do the students stay there?
They're up there for about 8 weeks altogether.
And they're giving some presentations tomorrow night at the Glacier Visitor Center?
Yes, I think I encourage everyone to come. They really do a wonderful job of it.
I imagine the gear has changed in the past number of years.
Yeah, they're not quite as much wood and steel and wool. And a lot more lightweight metal and, you know, plastic everything and a lot more fleece.
Where do the students end up going after they've done their research?
They've come from all over the world. We have students from Estonia and Switzerland and all the West Coast states, somebody from Whitehorse this year, a bunch of Canadians, people from Florida, Texas, Colorado, New Jersey, Montana, Massachusetts, Maine, so just about almost all the 50 states are from all over the place. And some of them will go back and finish their undergraduate degrees. Some of them are master's students and graduate students will go back to finish those. Others are bound for research, you know, in the world to help us keep track of things. So they all have different destinations.
Is there an average day as far as goes up there, what people end up doing each day?
Oh, what, a day in the life of an ice fielder? Mm-hmm. They have a plan of the day.
Don't you call yourself an ice fielder?
JIRP-er, I think. Juno Ice Field Research Program. It's easier just to say JIRP, J-I-R-P. Mostly they have, focuses around eating a lot because you spend a lot of your, you know, day trying to stay warm by burning calories. So there's breakfast, lunch, and dinner. Lunch is usually portable. Sometimes it's a rolled up pancake in your pocket or a lot of peanut butter on things. But, they, depending on what time, which part of the program they're in, the first part is safety training at our Lemon Creek station, and then as they move toward the Taku, they develop their research project. So each team could be doing something different on any given day.
How fast is the glacier retreating?
The Mendenhall is retreating about 400 feet a year. The Taku is advancing maybe half as fast, something like that. I think there'll be some reports about that on Saturday. So they're a little bit out of phase, those two.
What time do the reports start?
8 p.m. at the Mendenhall Glacier Visitor Center.
And it's free?
It's free. And then who knows, there might be Oreos. Lori might have some left over from Fireside. You never know. Can't promise.
Are they frozen Oreos?
I'm guessing they're thawed by now.
Tell me something about the glaciers that most people don't know.
Wow, glacier. Well, the neat part about glaciers that people might not know is they are covered by snow bridges, the parts of the glaciers that are cracked. And so when the snow starts to melt, these amazing blue chasms open up throughout the summer, and the ice field students get to figure out how to navigate around them and sometimes dangle in them or sometimes actually sample them from top to bottom to get the history of the glacier out of them. So they're really alive almost in my mind sometimes.
How come there aren't any ice worms in this glacier?
I don't think anyone knows that. I think we're going to have to develop a whole research project about that maybe next summer. We'll put an ice worm team out there.
Kathy Connor, thank you for coming by. Tomorrow night at 8 o'clock at the Mendenhall Glacier Visitor Center, there will be several presentations on the Juno Ice Field Project. Anything you'd like to add, I might have forgotten to ask?
I think you've covered it, Jeff. Thanks.
You're walking by the glacier in the evening. You catch a wicked urge to shake loose what is tight. You shake it to the left, you shake it to the right. You look down at the ice and you can't believe your eyes. Those itty bitty ice worms, hey, they're doing it too. They're doing the ice worm wiggle and the boogie woogie. You try to stop, but you lose control. And I can wiggle boogie and get you deep in your soul. Oh, you shake it to the left, you shake it to the right. You look down at the ice and you can't believe your eyes. Those itty bitty ice worms losing control too. They're doing the ice worm wiggle and the boogie woogie.
Maybe shaking it to the left, keep on shaking it to the right. You look down at the ice and you can't believe your eyes. Those pretty big ice worms who stayed up all night long with you. They're doing the ice worm wiggle and the boogie boogie.
The time is 3:16. You are tuned to KTOO News in Juneau here on a Juneau afternoon. I'm Jeff Brown, your host, filling in for Pat Moore. In the studio with us now is Bob Budar, who works on a film that's shown at the Silver Bow tonight. It's called Walking in Two Worlds. Bo, thank you for coming down the station today.
Thank you. Good pleasure to be here.
So tell me a little bit about the film in general, if you could, please. Where did you get the title from?
Well, Walking in Two Worlds came about from the reality that this Tongass forest has been here a long, long time, and the oldest inhabitants are the Tlingit and Haida tribes, going back as far as 10,000 years. And, of course, all that changed through the explorers and ultimately coming down to the Americans who settled here. And they have had to adapt to new ways, Western ways. And so what we do is in the film, we actually follow the lives of a Tlingit brother and a sister who were taught in the Western way of education, but actually had a Tlingit mother, and they did their traditional lifestyle in Huna. But they ended up moving to Juneau, and the brother became a CEO of Sea Alaska, and his sister decided to go back to the ancestral traditional way of life in Huna, and took her daughters to live there with her. And so what we do is represent what those ways that walking in two worlds, one in a modern corporate world, which looks at the way that we use nature or exploit it, versus the way the natives have traditionally looked at their forest.
What gave you the initial inspiration to do the film?
Well, I originally met a filmmaker who had an idea that he thought it would be really good to present documentaries about ancient forests. And of course there are a number of them, not only in North America but worldwide. And I had spent quite a while in Alaska, and I knew that the Tongass would just jumped out and said, well, if you want to really present a forest, how about this one? And He agreed, and I had a few contacts here in Juneau and other villages at the time, and so we collaborated with actually another producer as well, and we began the process, and little did we realize it would take us 5 years to complete the film. And as you know, we were covering pretty big distances from all the way from Sitka and Haines down to Huna, going down toward Cake and Kluwak and Ketchikan and Heidelberg. And so to do that, of course, we actually we actually sometimes would split up because there were just too many locations. And we met tribal elders, we met loggers, we met anthropologists, we met all kinds of people. And it was a very educational process, and so I ended up producing and directing the final product mostly from the Native perspective, but also how that interacts with the industry, the tourism, and of course the tribal and indigenous ways.
Would you say there's a point of view for the movie?
I would say it really covers quite a bit of the Native point of view, because there's a lot, I believe, that we the dominant society could learn from the way that they actually live together, and at least traditionally, and they still maintain a lot of these traditions and practice them, and so I think we found that out through getting stories from some of the elders, and I think that what we have is a very interesting portrait, if you will, of a way of life that's not just something that is passé, but is very much alive and is still very, very strong, vibrant. And I think that comes through, but it also comes through in a way that I think all of us have much to learn from the Native ways, at least the traditional ways, and that it's a whole process of, you know, everyone working together to in a way that accommodates the resources best and with as much justice as possible.
Is this a film about logging, brother and sister relationships, or Native issues, or all of the above and more?
Actually, it's a film about, it certainly presents the history of the Tongass before it was really logged, and that was back in the 50s and onward. But I think it was important to present the context of how all this began, how clear-cut logging began, and why it was done the way it was. And of course, when what we do is we also recount what happened when the Native Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act is passed, and that natives actually end up getting title to lands through the corporate mechanisms, and of course they, in order to profit, they have to use their assets, which they had not really done before. In an industrial way, so they had to hire companies that essentially helped them, you know, get into the logging business, and little did they realize how much impact that all this would have on their own lands, and so it's been a very long process of restoration and recovery, and it won't be back, at least the old growths won't be back for several hundred years, but I think a lot of lessons were learned, not just from the Native perspective, but I think from conservationists and then ecologists that came in and showed that there has to be a balance, and so we present that perspective as well.
What do you want people to walk away from the film feeling?
Well, I think what we really want to have people realize is how incredibly blessed everybody is to have such a resource at their doorstep. You know, I mean, and for people outside the state and internationally to realize that this is a very rare kind of forest. It's a temperate rainforest. And the the species are very abundant, you know, as well as you have large, you know, bodies of water, fjords, bays, straits, all these on the sea enveloping the forest, and that's very, very unusual. And I think that that's what we want to give people a sense of is not just of the tremendous diversity of wildlife here, but also the human history of the forest and how important it is that people have the connectedness to the forest by realizing how this can be part of their spiritual development. And this is what I think the Tlingit and Haida tribes really bring forth, and we hope that a lot of people get that message.
I'm talking with Bob Bludar. He's produced a film called Walking in Two Worlds. It's screening tonight at the Silver Bell. Tell me a little bit about your background, if you could, please.
I've been making films for a long time. I actually came up to Alaska in the 1970s, and I first went up to, I hitchhiked up here, and ended up in near Fairbanks, and I was actually to meet a friend who I didn't meet at the outset, but he was busy building log cabins out in the Kantishna country, not far from Denali. And so I went to one of the native villages not far from Fairbanks, and I started meeting them, and they were busy fishing salmon, of course, and one of the old native fishermen knew that my friend was not going to be back for a while, so I got involved, and he just put me to work and taught me a little bit of woodsmanship, I think my interest in kind of the native subsistence skills, as well as all their woodsmanship and so forth, I got attached to, and I just from there I started documenting traditional, whether it was making birch bark canoes, to dog sleds, to the traditional tanning of hides, to women sewing spruce root baskets, to ways of trapping. And, you know, essentially I became immersed in that made a series of films, first with the Athabascan tribes, and then someone told me I should made a connection, and I went up north to the Arctic slope, and I started working with the Inupiat Eskimos, and I spent a number of years doing films with them, especially in their traditional ways of hunting and fishing and whaling, and I continued to do these films, and ultimately ended up for the last 5-6 years spending a lot of time here in Southeast producing this film, and I continue to have a really, you know, just I really like to think of Alaska as my home, my real home. I still go back up to Kachemak Bay, where I have a cabin, and go fishing and just enjoy the lifestyle that I got to really appreciate over the years.
But why do you think it's important to document the native traditions?
I believe we have a lot to learn from the natives' way of the respect that they have for the nature around them. And I think that goes very deep into their past and continues to even through today. And I think I think that there's much for us to, as the more recent arrivals, to understand that if we can do the same, if we can have the same respect, I think we wouldn't be always looking at land as a commodity, and I think we would have look at land as more in a spiritual way that feeds our souls and that nourishes us at the same time, and that we ultimately become better human beings and be able to live with each other, especially in these kinds of remote places, and where I think that still remains true today.
You worked with Wanda Culpa in helping produce the film.
Yes, I would say that Wanda Culpa is my co-producer. She is also very much has a very major role in the film, and she, along with her brother Bob Loescher, were two the brother and sister that are very well whose relationship is very well presented, I think, in this documentary. And I think that I have to really say that without Wanda, I think I would have made a lot of mistakes. I have to say that, you know, this is one of the common practices of outsiders coming in and not living in long enough or getting into people's hearts and souls. And I think that working with Wanda really allowed me to really and truly understand the much more, at least the Tlingit way of life. And I think that I have to say she was a very instrumental in presenting what I think is a very well balanced documentary.
I'm talking with Bob Bodar about the film Walking in Two Worlds, screening tonight at the Silver Bow Inn. Is there a cost to get in?
This is open to the public. It's free. So this will be at this evening's at 7 o'clock and 9 o'clock at the Silver Bow.
Will there be a time for question and answers following?
There will be, yes. And we hope that I was hoping to have Wanda here, but she's waiting for the plane to get clearance to come here from Hoona. So hopefully she'll be here this evening as well.
Do you have a website, or are the videos available?
Yes, we will have videos, DVDs, and the website is walking in two, the number two, worlds.com. So walking in two worlds.com.
And Bill, thank you very much for coming by. Is there anything you'd like to add I might have forgotten to ask?
I think we have it. And I just want to say that we will have this film screened in over the next until the 24th, and we're going from tonight in Juneau to tomorrow in Haines, and the 17th in Sitka, the 18th in Angoon, the 19th in Cake, the 20th in Hoona, the 21st at Klawak, the 22nd in Heidelberg, the 23rd in Ketchikan. And there will be posters, and we will be, if you go to the website, again, walking in number two, worlds.com, you can get the actual times and locations of those screenings. So we hope we'll see more of you.
And Bo, thank you very much for coming down to the station today. 7 o'clock at the back room at the Silver Bow.
Okay. Well, you're welcome.
Ever blue at this point. to me, it's up to you. Amazon is calling.
Help this planet Earth.
With voices from the jungle.
Help this planet Earth.
Hear the tree that's falling.
Help this planet Earth.
Rainforests are crying.
Help this planet Earth.
Stay evergreen, ever blue, as it was in the beginning. We've got to see it through. Up to me, it's up to you. Ocean's wave is rumbling.
Help this planet Earth.
With voices from the sea wave.
Help this planet Earth.
Water's for the drinking.
Help this planet Earth.
Beluga whales are singing.
Help this planet Earth.
In the beginning, we've got to see it through. Oh, evergreen, ever blue. At this point in time, it's up to me, it's up to you.
It's 3:36 and you are tuned to KTWO News in Juneau. That was Raffi. In the studio with us now is Katie Bosler from the University of Alaska Southeast, here to talk about some very important things going on as far as the university is concerned.
It's always important as far as the university is concerned, Jeff.
That's where I got my education.
Your edumacation?
That's right.
Okay. Well, folks, it's August, mid-August, and school is starting September 2nd at the University of Alaska Southeast, so I want to encourage those of you who are enrolled to register for classes. It's very important that you do register. We know that there are some people who are even getting some financial aid who haven't been able to register yet. So that's important. And if you want to get more information about that, you can call the registrar's main desk at 796-6000.
About how many classes are available at UAS? And I just asked for a ballpark figure.
Ballpark figure, I would say hundreds, but that's I better do my homework next before I come here next time, Jeff.
You can count them all right now. Got a couple hours.
Yes. Well, you know, the thing about UAS is you can work on your degree program, right? Or if some of the people just want to take a class or two at a time, and some people, that's the way they earn their degree, is by taking a class or two at a time. So we do have openings in some classes in particular. Those would be Tlingit and Haida in our Alaska Native Languages program. And, you know, Alaska Native Languages have really been taking off at the University of Alaska Southeast over the last few years, especially under the leadership of Huni Lance Twitchell, our director of the Alaska Native Languages and Culture program.
He's really great.
Yeah, he's just fantastic. And so, you know, you don't have to be Alaska Native to take a Tlingit or Haida class. And so people, this is a language of the land and our local culture, and so people are signing up, new people, to take these courses every semester. So those, we have openings in those courses, so look into that. If you want to find out more information about any classes at UAS, you can go to the website, uas.alaska.edu/schedule. Click on that fall 2014 schedule, and then it has kind of a nice, you know, way to search for classes in different departments. Other classes that have openings are printmaking and sculpture in our art department, Spanish, environmental economics, and basic firearms. How's that for?
That's a mix.
A variety. That's Alaskan. You can. I love that.
I'm
environmental economics or basic firearms.
I'm looking for basic counterfeiting.
Or. Really? I don't know if we have that, Jeff.
Give yourself time. Maybe now, soon you'll have to do that to solve the budget problems.
Exactly. So those are all pretty much courses that are you can take at the main campus. At the Technical Education Center, also known as our School of Career Education here downtown, here are some courses that are opening. This one sounds pretty cool. Auto Mechanics Open Lab. So this is 5:30 to 11. You bring your own vehicle to work on, and the only stipulation is that it arrived just before class and has to be able to be removed from the premises by the end of the class itself. So I guess they don't want, like, big oil stains. They're doing a remodel over there. I don't think they want to mess up the floor too much. But that, the thing I like about this is a lot of us, you know, if we have that job to work on, and it could be something you need to work on with your automobile, you might be putting it off or not be finding that frame of time. And here, folks, you can just kind of get this done on Fridays after work. There's an open lab for auto mechanics, 5:30 to 11, and I imagine you can get some assistance from one of our faculty with that. Another class related to that, Introduction to Automotive Technology, 6 to 10 o'clock on Mondays. This is an introduction to all components of an automobile. And we also have, those of you who are interested in EMT training, an Emergency Medical Technician 1. That's going to be every Saturday, starting the 2nd of September through the 13th of December, 8 a.m. to 4:30 p.m., and every Wednesday. And Wednesday and Saturday, okay. Saturday all day, Wednesday six evenings. This will be in the time frame of the 2nd of September through the 13th of December. And this course provides required contact hours for the State of Alaska EMS. So those of you who are involved with EMS, EMT. Also, there are construction, CAD, and diesel classes still available. So lots available for your personal edification with the UAS School of Career Education. If you want to have questions about any of these classes, you can give Dana Mackey a call at 796-6120, 796-6120. And again, you can go to that fall class schedule to look up any of these classes online at uas.alaska.edu/schedule. And we, you know, we do have the printed version of the class listing around town. I know there's still a lot of those at places like libraries and cafes and Capital City Weekly newsstands. So the thing about signing up for classes, Jeff, is you can sign up online if you're already a registered student in a program. But if you're not, you need to give a call to 796-6100 or 796-6000. Or you can come to our one-stop welcome center in the Novotny building in the kind of the middle of the UAS campus.
A lot of stuff going on all the time at UAS. I know you got the evening at Egan.
Yes, evening at Egan, folks, this week, this fall is starting really soon. It's starting September 5th. So we're going to have a very full season evening at Egan, September 5th through November 21st. That's every Friday at 7 o'clock at either the Egan Lecture Hall or the library. And, Jeff, as early as next week, I'll have details on all of these events, and we'll have them up on the web, and you'll see that Sunday paper in the Empire listing of all these programs. But I can give people just sort of a little sneak peek preview for September. September 5th, the World Affairs Council is bringing in Sulak Sivaraksa. This is an activist from Thailand and academic, and his he's going to be talking on the wisdom of sustainability. When you think of about capitalism and climate change and cooperation. So that's going to be the 5th of September at the Egan Lecture Hall, Friday night. Then the 12th of September, I'm really looking forward to this, Dr. Richard Nelson from SICA and Hank Lentfer, well-known in Southeast Alaska and also wonderful writers and thinkers, they have been doing this incredible project over the last few years called Soundscapes of Glacier Bay. And they've been going into Glacier Bay with very high-end, high-tech recording equipment and recording the sounds of nature. And, you know, Hank's been writing about it in Orion Magazine and on their blog. So this is a National Park Service project. And we'll have more information about that, but I just want to give people a heads up. That's going to be at the Egan Library on the 12th of September. And then another great event, again in the library, the 19th of September, Cross Currents, Literary Confluence of Writers and Readers. And this will be looking at sort of cross-cultural reading and writing with Sherry Simpson and Ernestine Hayes, again, two really rock star like Nelson and went for Alaska writers. Sherry Simpson spent a lot of time in Juneau growing up. She now resides in Anchorage and now is actually on her way to New Mexico. And then, of course, Ernestine Hayes is one of our esteemed English faculty at the university. So that's the 19th. And then finally, the 26th of September, Tom Thornton. Again, people are very familiar with Tom. He has done a lot of groundbreaking work in the Southeast Alaska Tlingit place names. I believe he's British, and he's written a book about Southeast Alaska Tlingit place names. He'll be giving a presentation on the 26th in the Egan Library. So just September itself is pretty exciting for Evening Egan, and we'll have more details coming up on our website, the poster you'll see around town, and also the ad that will all be coming out in the next couple weeks.
All right, Katie Bosler from the University of Alaska Southeast, thank you for coming down on the station today.
Well, thank you, Jeff, and bon voyage.
Si.
That's what you'll say in Mallorca.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Friday, the 15th of August, 2014. Birthday of the Swedish novelist Stieg Larsson, born in Skelleftehamn, Sweden, 1954, took up fiction writing as a way to make some extra money. Started in 2001, he had written two novels, started on a third when he approached an editor. He was planning 10 detective thrillers called the Millennium Series, but he died of a heart attack the following year. His three novels published posthumously. The first, in Swedish, is called Men Who Hate Women, better known as The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo. It's the birthday of Mary Jo Salter, Grand Rapids, Michigan, 1954, went off to Harvard, took a poetry class from Elizabeth Bishop. She's published several poetry collections. Once asked what she would be if she weren't a poet, she said, "I'm a writer because I'm not a composer. That's what I'd really love to be, a composer of long, complex symphonies and operas, to produce the wordless power of music to move people in that way. I'm stuck with being better at words." It's the birthday of the essayist Thomas De Quincey, Manchester, England, 1785. He was fluent in Greek as a young man, moved to the Lake District, became a friend of Wordsworth and Coleridge, and then in 1813 he became addicted to opium. Chronically in debt, had to take a job writing articles for magazines, but he's best remembered for his book Confessions of an English Opium Eater. It was on this date, 1935, the humorist Will Rogers and his friend and pilot Wiley Post died in a plane crash, flying from Fairbanks, Alaska to Point Barrow. Post was flying a plane that he had cobbled together from parts of two different planes. Lockheed, the plane manufacturer, had warned him that the plane could be unsafe. It was hard to control. The nose tended to dip down. And when Post took off from a lagoon, the engine stalled when they were just 50 feet in the air. The plane's nose dropped, and both men died instantly. It was on this date, 1843, the Tivoli Gardens opened in Copenhagen, the second oldest amusement park in the world. The oldest is in Klampenborg, near Copenhagen. Designed as a pleasure garden with flowers, cafes, theaters, and bandstands, in 1943, Nazi sympathizers burned most of the buildings to the ground, and it had to be rebuilt. A few years ago, Tivoli Gardens became the first amusement park to operate entirely on wind-generated power. And it's the birthday of Denise Chavez, born in Las Cruces, New Mexico, 1948. Her first novel was Face of an Angel, came out in 1994. The protagonist is a waitress, and Chavez herself had spent more than 30 years waiting on tables. Here's a poem for today by Mary Jo Salter, Absolute September. How hard it is to take September straight, not as a harbinger of something harder, merely like suds in the air, cool scent scrubbed clean of meaning, or innocent of the cold thing coldly meant. How hard the heart tugs at the end of summer, and longs to haul it in when it flies out of hand at the prompting of the first mild breeze. It leaves us by degrees only, but for one who sees summer as an absolute pure state of light and heat, the height to which one cannot raise a doubt. As soon as one leaves off the tree, no day following can fall free of the drift of melancholy. Absolute September by Mary Jo Salter from A Kiss in Space, published by Knopf and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac, supported by the Poetry Foundation, offering poetry podcasts to listen to and thousands of poems to read at poetryfoundation.org. Produced by Joy Biles, assisted by Teresa Burgess. Be well, do good work, keep in touch.
Support comes from the Tongass Democrats, hosting the annual picnic and potluck on Sunday, August 17th from noon to 3 p.m. at Sandy Beach Large Shelter, with municipal and state office candidates present to answer questions. Information at 321-2285.
Hi, this is Dan DiBartolo, the director for the Permanent Fund Dividend Division. Did you know that August 31st is the deadline for submitting required documents to the PFD office? It is also the cutoff for adding or changing voluntary contributions to the UA College Savings Program and PICLIC Give. Head to pfd.alaska.gov and click on the blue My PFD Info button to check your status or make contribution changes. This message sponsored by the Alaska Department of Revenue and aired by ABA and this station.
Time is 3:51 and you are tuned to KTOO News in Juneau here on a Juneau afternoon. I'm Jeff Brown. I'm filling in for your host, Pat Moore, who couldn't be here today. In studio with us now, we have Sally Donaldson and Patience, who's here this week to talk to people about the marimba, and he's also part of the Food Truck Friday, which is going on this evening at the Juneau Arts and Humanities Council. Sally and Patience, thank you very much for coming down to the station today.
Yeah, thanks, Jeff, for having us.
Thank you, Jeff.
Patience, you've been working with the marimba for how long? How did you get started playing it?
My history with marimbas, I could say that, I mean, it's way back when I was too young. I grew up in a community where we used to do music with marimbas, African drumming and biras. So, like, I mean, I received formal training with marimbas through oral tradition, whereby you learn through listening and imitation. So that's when it all began.
What type of different types of marimbas are there?
I would say that there's different types of marimbas, but the marimba instrument itself is with different sets, different pieces that that are named. Make up the overall marimba family structure set, like the soprano, that's one, the smallest one, and then you've got the tenors and the altos, and then the baritone, and then the bass. That is actually the different parts that make a marimba set.
So you're originally from Zimbabwe, and now you're living in Botswana.
Yes, sir.
What does it mean to the people of your culture, as far as an instrument?
Yeah, an instrument in Zimbabwe or probably in Botswana as well, it resembles the cultural significance of musical arts of that country. That's the way how we want the world to perceive us as issues of cultural identity are concerned. So a marimba instrument, I mean, resembles the culture of the Zimbabwean people, because that's when we can get to excel by propagating our cultures to different people in the world as well.
I love the marimba. It seems to be very popular with some people here.
Yeah, I have seen that in the way that the people here in the USA have taken marimbas. I think you've taken to a greater level, of which it's quite commendable, and it's very good that you guys have found, I mean, some common ground into the love that we have for the marimbas, and they are playing it very, very well.
How do songs get composed on the marimba?
Sorry?
How do songs get composed?
Yeah, mainly nowadays, I mean, because of technology and that culture is dynamic, things are changing. But originally, marimba songs are composed through the music that we used to play long back ago from the mbira instrument itself. There are songs that are cultural songs that are composed from way back, like from different traditions in Zimbabwe, which were put on the mbira instrument. So we take those songs from the mbira instrument and try to relate them on the marimba, just trying to play the instrumental part of the songs that were composed way back, long back ago.
Seems to be an instrument that has people coming together as one.
You mean? Sorry?
It's a very friendly instrument.
Yeah, yeah. The marimba instrument, because of the way how the family of instruments come together to form a marimba band, we've got different, I mean, like I've said before, different pieces of the marimba. So it brings people together because everyone has got a role to play. When, like you are saying, you are playing a song now, every person, I mean, it's very vital in making a song in the marimba because you've got the small marimbas, the bigger marimbas as well. So we bring this together now. It's an instrument that brings society together and instrument that brings harmony into the people that are playing. It's like a team.
Sally Donaldson, have you been playing marimba this past week?
I have, Jeff. It's really been fun working with patients, and we're so excited to have him here in Juneau.
Was it hard for you to learn? When I tried playing marimba, I couldn't keep the beat.
Yeah, the beat was not the problem, but finding the notes and remembering. Well, I guess the beat is hard too, because a lot of the African rhythms are not straight rhythms like our folk music. It's all kind of everything kind of sounds the same in that way. But in African rhythms, the rhythms are very offbeat. There's a lot of syncopation, and you have to really listen. And like Patience was saying, it's they're played as a community, so people get, you know, there's a strong beat that's happening, and then there are other beats and rhythms and notes that go in and out of that.
Has it been fun?
It's great. Yeah, it's really been fun.
So, Patience, what's going to be happening tonight at Food Truck Friday?
Yeah, tonight we're going to showcase what I've been doing throughout the week. I had the pleasure of meeting the citizens, the senior citizens of this country of Alaska. That, I mean, I had a marimba band with those guys. They enjoyed it very much. Like I'm saying, a marimba is a way of bringing the community together, and as well as a way of keeping you busy as a human being. Music does wonders to your livelihood and to your as your well-being as well. There's things that happen in your life if you like engage yourself into music. So for the senior citizens, we've got their band. They're going to be playing a girl, and we have some good lessons with them. And the children as well, I think ages 12, 13, 14, up to 15 years, they're going to be playing as well. And then these Njuzu guys, the marimba ensemble of Alaska here, they're also going to be playing. I'm going to be playing with them as well. And like what she's been saying, we need Ali to present African music from Zimbabwe is in such a way that it is what it is, because they've got different rhythms that are going to be coming exposed together through the marimba instruments, polyrhythmic structures, polyphony, and so on.
What time are you on tonight?
Half past five or
5:30?
5:30, yeah.
Mm-hmm. 5:30 to 7, I believe.
7, yeah.
All right, should be a lot of fun. That's happening tonight at the Jag. Thank you so much for coming, Dan. Is there anything like that I might have forgotten to ask?
No, we're just really happy that Patience was able to come and be with us this week, and we're just grateful to him for sharing the music with us.
Thanks for coming by.
Thank you, sir.
And you are tuned to KTAO News in Juneau. Next Monday on a Juneau afternoon, we'll talk with City Manager Kim Kiefer about CBJ activities, learn about the Alaska Children's Choir's, the Africa Children's Choir's September concert. Author Debbie Miller will be here to highlight her recent children's books. I'll learn about Saturday's Recovery Fest. That's a week from Saturday with guest Jimmy Chapman. That man is Olmec Bruno and Yuzga Moore on a Juneau afternoon. In the forecast for tonight, scattered rain showers, patchy fog later on, low temperatures around 52 degrees. Saturday, mostly cloudy skies with patchy fog in the morning and isolated showers, high temperatures around 61 degrees. Sunday, rain heavy at times, high temperatures around 57 degrees. Monday, looks like rain is likely with high temperatures around 61 degrees. Have a good weekend.
This is KTOO Juno. We broadcast at 104.3 FM in downtown Juno and Douglas. We rebroadcast on translators K2.